No, I don't either. I'm afraid we all got sucked into that jackpot, though. This is Arc Midnight, Caravan to Midnight's sixth element, and it is my pleasure to welcome to Caravan to Midnight, for the first time, Mr. Michael T. McKibben. And Mike has quite a story to tell. You may have heard of him. I would not be at all surprised to learn that you had. But Michael McKibben's career spans two phases: international Christian music ministry and technology innovation. In 2006, he was awarded U.S. patent number 7,139,761 for what is now called social networking. Oh, yes. He credits his earlier ministry experience with the inspiration to conceive perhaps one of the most important inventions since Thomas Edison's light bulb. The theft of Mr. McKibben's invention is arguably the greatest larceny in the history of the world, since the value of social networking and collateral applications reaches into the trillions of dollars. Curiously, Wikipedia has consistently refused to publish anything about McKibben, whose accomplishments, even without his social networking invention, are remarkable, to put it really, really mildly. And so, without further ado, we welcome for the first time to the Bridge of the Ark, Michael T. McKibben. Hey, Mike, thanks so much for coming on the program.
John, it's great to meet you. I know that many of the folks following our story are your loyal listeners, so it's a real pleasure.
Well, tonight's episode being the theft and weaponization of social networking pretty much says it all. So we have a few minutes. We'll have a break coming up here in about, I don't know, almost 5 minutes. But give us a little exposition here. What led you to develop and effectively invent social networking? How far back do we go, and when did it all start? Just tell us what happened.
Right. Well, I won't go all the way back, but I will go back to the mid-90s.
That's pretty far.
Got a contract here in Columbus to rebuild AT&T's email system. And so, and we did that. We did something that Bell Labs said would take 3 years and $6 million. We did in 6 months with $1 million. And in the process of implementing that within AT&T, we also supported their entire infrastructure worldwide. Now, back in the day, I was an engineer. I was an entrepreneur. I was a writer. I did a lot of leadership and organizational development work. So when I began working with AT&T and seeing this big business problem, I realized that as the internet was emerging, there was going to need to be a whole new way of handling what's called collaboration, simply email, but also other things, in a large-scale internet environment. And so what I could see was the market, and that was at that time Microsoft and Apple and AT&T and the telecommunications world, was moving down a path, and I'll hold up my right hand. They were going down that path. And I realized that that was the wrong path. So what I did in Columbus, Ohio, is I pulled together a team of people. We specifically went underground and didn't tell anybody what we were doing, because by then I had had a lot of experiences with large corporations stealing my ideas. And so we literally went underground, and we decided that we weren't going to come out and tell anybody what we were doing until we had done it. And so with that scenario, I raised all the money for our company. I led the design. I'm a civil engineer by training, so planning and design is definitely within my skill set. And so we set out to decide what was wrong with collaboration, and could we develop a new approach using the emerging internet? And to cut a very long story short, right before the year 2000, our engineering team that I had put together had a magic aha moment. And we knew once we had figured this out that we had a tiger by the tail, because most of us had done one of the major systems in the world. And so I very quietly went to Washington and was recommended to a particular patent attorney who was a law professor at George Washington University, and he was advising the White House, Congress, key corporations, and in the military. And with that, I thought I had the right guy. And yeah. So he agreed we had patentable inventions. And what we discovered is he said that we not only had one or two, we had maybe 60. And so with that, we will stop the story there because I can hear the music, and then I'll pick up on the other side.
All right. Very, very good. Wow. Unbelievable. Well, a theft of intellectual property is certainly nothing new in this right. world. Everybody's always trying to get over on somebody else. But thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen, for being present tonight. And if you're listening in archive, good for you, and thank you very much for supporting us, because this is truly listener and member supported media. It really, really is. Some claim to be, most are not. Most have big sponsors, most have government grants, all kinds of things, money coming from many, many different directions. Money that it takes to run this program, to get the airtime to go over the air, and to produce these programs comes from our family members. So go to caravantomidnight.com and join at whatever level you can. You'll be doing a great service, not only for yourself, but for a lot of people around the world. I'm John B. Wells. We'll be right back with Mike McKibben. Somber thought, but at least the music's pleasant. Slightly unpleasant truth. Just little robots. Yes, we are. Becoming more robot-like every day. All right, we now continue as quickly as we can get back to it, which is seconds, mere seconds. Mr. Michael T. McKibben and the theft and weaponization of social media. So you went underground with a solemn vow. We're not going to tell anybody what we're doing. And you find out that you don't have just one patent, but you got about 60. So just take us back into it, Mike.
So we were recommended by some very prominent people to select this particular patent attorney. The good news was, on paper, he was probably the most qualified intellectual property attorney in the world. The bad news is we discover much later, I'm talking 15 years later, that he is the chief intellectual property attorney for what is generally called the deep state. But more specifically, is the chief outside counsel to IBM and the British Pilgrim Society. And when we discovered that, we realized that this man wasn't what he claimed. And what then occurred was several years of confidence tricks by this attorney, who we thought was promoting or protecting our intellectual property, but was in fact aligning with IBM. IBM put in $40 million into a fund, and they developed something called the IBM Eclipse Foundation, and he proceeded to get a copy of our source code as our intellectual property attorney. And then within about 11 weeks, our source code was distributed to all the companies of Silicon Valley.
I can't believe
all the ones. Unbelievable. That was a month after 9/11, by the way.
That sounds about right, timing-wise. So which British society was that? I missed the first word.
The Pilgrims Society.
Oh, the Pilgrims. I thought that might be what you said, but I didn't read the word. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we Those have guys discovered again. In the last 10 years of investigation that is the group that is leading. It should be the name being used instead of Deep State. And that all of these technology controls that are being implemented all over the world are really being driven out of London, not out of Washington or even within the U.S. military or DARPA. Those are all secondary corporations to the primary drivers in London. That's been our long-fought investigation to decide or to determine who stole our technology and why they stole it. So we know these things now. It's taken a long time, but all roads lead back to London.
I have long suspected that England, specifically London, has been running the world and every war it's been involved in the whole time.
Right. Well, what we did back in the day, we took our case. We sued Facebook for patent infringement in 2008. In 2010, we had a split verdict. And in that verdict, the jury decided and agreed that Facebook was infringing our patent. But then what we watched was the judicial corruption kick in, and the federal courts protected Facebook then all the way up to the Supreme Court. And I was an entrepreneur. I wasn't into a lot of this the politics. But when we saw our courts uniformly not protect us as the inventors, we knew something was wrong. And so after the Supreme Court would not take our case, we then decided, well, we could either tuck our tail between our legs and go home and whimper away, which isn't me. And so what we started doing is we started investigating every element of this that we knew. And the first thing we investigated was looking at the financial holdings of all the judges in our case. And lo and behold, wouldn't you find that every one of them had mountains of Facebook stock in preparation for the Facebook IPO in 2013. And for those of you who know judicial ethics, you realize that that's not proper. You don't have a judge with a conflict of interest hearing a case where he is going to benefit financially by making a decision favorable to one party or the other. So with that, we realized that something was horribly wrong, and not really knowing what the answer to our question was, but knowing what the question was, who did it, how they do it, when did they do it. And that has taken from then, from 2012, 13, to now, to really unpack this story. And as we did that, we began to see the involvement of our defense industry. We saw DARPA in the middle of it, we saw the NSA, the CIA, and we kept tracking back. And as we got to the end of World War II, we started seeing that our intelligence agencies signed a secret agreement in 1946, which agreed that we would give all of our intelligence to the British. Did you realize that, John?
I never knew this.
We agreed in 1946 on March 5th, the same day that Winston Churchill was making a tour with Truman, and in the back of a train car announced that we have a new special relationship, and he announced the beginnings of the Cold War. That was the very day we agreed to give up our sovereignty and intelligence to the British, to MI6, MI5, GCHQ. And when we saw that, we said, okay, now we're seeing that all the history we've learned about our relationship with Britain is probably propaganda. Mm-hmm. And so then we continued to unpack this, and then we began to see the collusion, the conspiracy, really, with our entire telecommunication world. And then we marched that back to the formation of NBC and RCA, and then we marched that back to British Marconi and Marconi Wireless, and now we're getting into World War One and before World War One, and the story has just continued to unpack itself, until we have now, we believe we see some of the guiding principles of the British Empire and their obsession, their demonic obsession with controlling the world. And so that's where we've gotten to this day. And as you said, you've long suspected that the wars that we've participated in have all been British inspired, and I would agree with that. And what I started doing from an investigation viewpoint is I didn't want to talk about speculation. So what we decided to do is we started looking at each element of this story. And each time we would go look for judicially recognizable evidence to prove something and not just speculate about it. And so we have spent the last year, 10, 12 years, gathering that information together so that when we said something, we could prove it in a court of law. And that's called judicially recognizable evidence. In other words, it's so recognized to be true that you don't have to further verify it in court. And so that's what we've been publishing these last 12 years with a whole team of people all over the planet, because we could see something was wrong. And so now I see why there was this determination by our people in Washington to steal our internet technology. It's because they had made a practice of stealing whatever technology they needed in order to maintain their power. And they've been doing this well into the early 1800s, and especially related to telecommunications and collaboration, all the way from the telegram with Morse code all the way forward. The bankers in London knew that if they could control communication, then they could control their profits forever. And they started that pattern, and they've never stopped to this day.
So that's the special relationship. I kept hearing that phrase being used over and over again, special relationship, that term. And now we know what it is. Wow.
Well, I always heard it. I thought it was kind of warm and fuzzy, you know. And by the way, I used to live in the UK. Two of my children were born there, and I love the country. There are wonderful people there. And so I had no ill feeling toward anything British. But what I'm seeing here confronted with facts is that the elitists within the British culture have no interest in America. In fact, they want to dominate and control America. And they have done for well over 100 years. You've probably heard of Cecil Rhodes.
Oh, yes.
And his Rhodes Scholarship. Well, that was a scholarship intended to recruit Oxford University students into the Pilgrim Society so that they would specifically develop their financial and legal and propaganda arms in order to achieve Rhodes's 200-year plan. And the centrality of that plan was to make sure America was British again. And that was in 1902. And they haven't stopped. I mean, you'd think, well, they'd get tired of what they're doing. But what we see now, there's a whole other layer here that gets into what can only be described as demonic activity that is so old, embedded within the British Empire, that we conclude that there's no one person driving this, but rather Mammon is driving this. And that we are, in fact, facing today Mammon, and we're battling Mammon. And you know, Jesus said that. He said, you can't serve two masters. You're going to love the one and hate the other, or hate the one and love the other. You can't serve God and Mammon. And I think we are facing Mammon right now.
And what is what's Mike McKibben's definition of Mammon?
Mammon is the evil entity that's described in the Bible by Jesus himself. That it is the power behind money.
Mm-hmm. The evil influence or false object worship and devotion to. Let's see, I've got a definition up here. I had to look it up, so I'm not ashamed to say it. It was taken by medieval writers as the name of the devil, of covetousness, and revived in this sense by Milton. Quote, others have forsaken Mammon in search of something on a more spiritual plane. I think we should remember our Milton very much. All right, we will we'll take a quick break, and we'll come back as fast as we can. This is Ark Midnight. Please stand by. Music by foxes and all kinds of foxes in our collective hen house, without a doubt. We carry on now. Mr. Michael T. McKibben. Our program theme tonight, if you're just joining, is the theft and weaponization of social networking, and we just got to the demonic part and how actually the British government has been running the world well for a few centuries now. They really have. I couldn't help noticing that, you know, you pick up these things here and there and you read things here and there, and before long you've got a bunch of note cards up there like the movie makers do. They're note cards. I think Ron Howard used to do it. Maybe a lot of them do. Put your 3x5s mm-hmm. up there and start moving stuff around. And I came to the conclusion that, wow, it looks to me as though the British invented the concentration camp, witness South Africa with the hundreds of thousands of, may I say, white women and children being starved to death in concentration camps at the hands of the Brits during the Boer War. And then, communism got pushed into Russia, China, India. They're working on Brazil pretty strong here, and certainly South Africa. Canada is looking pretty shaky, and it's coming here now, and I think the British government is behind all of it. And I hasten to add, not the British people, the British government, which you've used the word demonic. It appears to me, well, I mean, they were the ones with the torture chambers. They used to really delight in drawing and quartering people and removing entrails. They were real keen on that stuff, all kinds of torture and craziness. So what do you think the demonic element is within the British government, or is it obvious?
Yeah, it's not obvious. It wasn't obvious to me. And we have, I would say, in the last 6 months, really started centering on that. And I really believe that's because the Holy Spirit is guiding this research. But one of the things that started popping up relative to the financial system is the, and we've now found primary documents to confirm this, that the real focus of the British banking system was to control currency in order to control labor. And when you think about it, money that's not usury is really a replacement for human labor. And so what happened in the early part of the 1800s is the British disengaged the real value of labor from paper money, and therefore began a trek of paper money that allowed them to really control the labor cost. And that's what we see that they were focused on, is controlling labor. And part of the reason for that is that most of the members of the Bank of England for decades in the early 1800s were slavers. They owned slaves. They had plantations in the Caribbean and in South Africa. And so the cost of slavery was a big issue for them. And one of the things that we never see talked about, but when you think about it, it makes sense, is how does somebody that owns a bunch of slaves maintain control of those slaves and they don't walk away? Well, the answer is they do it through abuse. They do it through various types of abuse, rape, buggery or sodomy, and whipping. And what we see is that the British slavers got very good at knowing how to maintain their labor in a subservient role and stop them from running away. And so what we see is huge fortunes were made in the British East India Company as they took their swords around the world and subdued other cultures in order to maintain their financial system, which was based on slavery. And then we see in the early 1833 was the Abolition Act, where slavery was finally outlawed for good in the British colonies. And then what emerged after that was it was fiendishly brilliant, because at some point, some of these accountants in the City of London realized that, you know what, if we create debt slaves with paper money, with fake money, then we can get slaves from any race, black, yellow, brown, red, we encourage them to go into debt, and then we will make sure they never come out of debt. Mm-hmm. And by doing that, they created debt slaves. And we actually have documents where they discuss in about the time of Lincoln. They actually discuss that we actually realized that slavery was more expensive, the kind we had done on the plantation, because we had to house the slaves. And so what they were doing was patting themselves on the back that they could create debt slaves, and therefore that's when they replaced their black and brown slaves after 1833 with white slaves and yellow slaves. And they did it through debt slavery. They would encourage these people all over the world to emigrate to some British colony. They would even loan them money. And then once they got there, these people would run out, wouldn't be able to sustain the loan that they had created, and therefore they went into debt slavery. And that's the system we have today. So what we can see here is that this whole banking system, that this fiat money system that was created in the early 1800s, actually in 1812, was a brilliant system for them to be able to maintain their control over labor. And because it's inflationary based, they needed wars every so often to flush out their inflation, and then they would use the wars to devalue the property of their enemy and then use their fake money to go in and buy it all up and therefore acquire more of the wealth, to the point today where, what's the statistic? The top 1% control something over half of all value in the world. So that system has continued to refine itself right up into our current moment. And it was based on labor.
Is there any breaking out of it?
Well, I think what we have to do is get rid of the paper system. Because as long as you put the creation of money into these people's hands through now the Federal Reserve, then they're going to be able to continue doing that. We've got to stop that.
Well, Mark, let me ask you, go on. No, go on. By the way, what?
By the way, all of the people that developed this system in Britain, and when I say all, I'm not being figurative, were attorneys. And so what we see here is that the legal systems that were created out of the British Empire were all self-serving for this economic system that was based on slavery. White, black, brown, red. And that's what makes this whole Black Lives Matter nonsense so ludicrous, because it was, in fact, white and yellow slaves that replaced black and brown slaves in many parts of the world where it was outlawed.
Well, I wonder how to do this individually. If we can't do a system-wide reset, I wonder if individuals can just withdraw from this system somehow and kind of freelance their own monetary system, so they can remain debt-free. But you're never debt-free. I mean, you still have your taxes. If you want to find out how much of your home you own, just get behind on your property taxes. You'll find out. So.
Right.
You know what I mean? So I'm thinking we're all the way in, and there may not be any way out.
Well, let's talk community. I think that the real key, what I have noticed in my last 10 years, and it's just me personally, is that where I was as a person who was part of this debt slave system, I was standing at a cliff looking down, and if I took one more step, I was going to step off. And so I think the real solution here is we've got to start taking steps back. There's no one magic solution. It's taking steps back. Now let's talk about communication. One of the things we've seen is that the long view of communication is, if I'm a banker, I'm a Rothschild banker, loaning money to the British Army to fight to actually burn down the White House in 1812. Actually, they did that in 1814. They started the war in 1812. I'm the Rothschild who's loaning money to the British Army to do that. Then in order to continue to turn my wealth, I've got to control the stock markets in the countries where I'm operating. And what they learned to do long ago was, if they could get early information signals about what was going on in the markets, they could play the market ahead of time. And so they, I mean, literally, this may sound funny, but they actually perfected carrier pigeons to, in fact, they used carrier pigeons to announce to their people in London that Napoleon had lost at Waterloo. And the Rothschilds made out like bandits as a result of that. And then they just kept doing that. And so there was this symbiotic relationship with the British government and the Bank of England, till at some point they actually became directors of the Bank of England as well. But the point here is that they knew communication was a key. And so from the very beginning, they've used this fiat currency to buy up and steal every communication technology that has existed ever since Samuel Morse invented Morse code. Because they knew if they could control the communication, they could get a leg up on the markets. And so they set out as a commitment, as a base commitment to do that. And then they realized that they could actually make markets out of lies. And so they started making up stories to make markets and make markets go up and down so that they could profit from that. So they very early on invested in the propaganda systems that go along with communication. And then they expanded that to newspapers. And then we get to Nikola Tesla and his invention of the wireless telegraphy. Well, everybody said, well, no, that's Marconi. No, it wasn't Marconi. Marconi was the Mark Zuckerberg of his time. He was a cardboard cutout. And so the British government, and this is all documented, well documented, by the way, in British parliamentary records, that the British government set up Marconi as the cardboard cutout to take all of Tesla's patents and make sure that the British government, the post office, and the Admiralty controlled all wireless communication worldwide. And they started doing that in the early 1890s. And if you looked at the letterheads on a lot of the businesses at that time, you would think you were looking at an internet address. That's how sophisticated this was. They had pretty much instant communication all around the planet once wireless started taking off around the time of World War I. And so then we had the wireless technology, and then at the end of the in 1918, at the end of World War I, there was a recognition that we were using all of the British wireless technology for World War I. So they were really controlling us then. And so what a then Deputy Navy Secretary by the name of Franklin Delano Roosevelt ordered AT&T, Westinghouse, Western Union, and British Marconi Wireless to merge together. Did you know this?
I did not.
In 1819, he ordered as an Assistant Secretary of the Navy. Now, keep in mind, David Sarnoff had been running Marconi Wireless out of New York, and David Sarnoff, within 10 years, was president of RCA, Radio Corporation of America. So the corporation that was created, called RCA, was a government-mandated communication system in the United States, and they ordered us basically to incorporate all of Marconi Wireless's British technology into our telecommunication in the U.S. And then within within 10 years, they started RCA, Radio Corporation of America. And then, most people don't realize this, it was RCA then that created National Broadcasting Company, NBC.
I wonder what the Victor part is, or if that's just
RCA Victor. RCA, that was Victor. Just a brand.
Gotcha.
That was a brand name.
Sorry. Excellent.
So the real focus of RCA was to consolidate all of this technology. Now, one of the reasons they did that is because there were a lot of patent holders who had invented different solutions for telecommunication. But as we can see now, this long view of the bankers to control communication meant that they had to figure out a way to steal all these. They were either going to force they did force AT&T to share their patents and also Westinghouse, but then they stole other technologies from around the world to consolidate those and create RCA. So RCA was a fake company from the get-go. And so what they did is they combined all that technology. They continued to use it to make markets and to control their banking. And if you recall, that was the time of the robber barons. And so those robber barons were using this technology to make their fortunes. And this was J.P. Morgan, Warburg, Andrew Carnegie, John D. Rockefeller, all the names we know now, Chase, were all a part of this system. And so communications and propaganda has always been a construct of bankers who want to control markets and then therefore control the cost of labor. And that cost of labor is the key mechanism they have found for controlling the world. And they learned it long ago.
They did. So it wasn't about providing any convenience to people around the world. It was all about controlling everything.
That was the way they sold it to the average person.
Yeah.
They always have a way. Well, they always have a reasonable story to go along with their agenda that gets the people to buy along with it. And there seems to be always a titillation factor associated with it, which is why we give in to it.
Mm-hmm. Is there a committee of three or five or a half dozen or something, the high table, so to speak, where just a very few people occupy those chairs at that table, and that table is where the actual and proverbial buck stops? Or is it a machine of people who just come in and out, and it's and the secrecy is controlled by bloodline?
Well, I mean, it is all those things. What we believe, in from all of our research now, is that the inner circle is a group within the British Privy Council, and it's not very many. But I think at the head table is Mammon. I don't think it's a human being.
You really don't, do you?
I think we're literally dealing with the devil, no.
You know, I don't want to wax juvenile here, and I want the vast majority of our airtime tonight to be yours. But have you seen this thing about where you fold the 5 and the 10 and the 20 and the 50 and the $100 bill, and depending on how you fold them, you see the two towers, they're standing there, and then you see them beginning to powder from the top, and then, oh, they're powdering even more, and then they're gone completely, and then you have this thing that looks like an hourglass, but without the waist. It's not the defined two globes there for the sand to go from one to the other, but just elliptical. They're like reverse ellipses. It looks like an altar of some sort. And then if you do it to the $1 bill, to the Great Seal, you wind up with this goat man looking thing. I mean, I'm not kidding you. And I'm thinking, this is one hell of a coincidence. This has to have been done deliberately. Are these people really, I mean, to most of us, to most normal people, we can't believe, I've said this 100 times probably, but we can't imagine that there are people in black robes doing all sorts of weird things, conjuring and bloods involved and sacrifice and every other thing. But this turns out to be a real thing, just like it was in the Dark Ages and the medieval period and all of that. This is real, yeah?
Well, I have seen a lot of those things you're talking about, and I think that what we have discovered is these people are very into symbolism because they're into Satanism. And I don't say that. I say that from a technical standpoint, because when you think about it, Any group of people that passes down through their bloodline the skill set to subdue other cultures and to subdue other people as slaves and to profit from that and then to pass that profit on to their children can't be normal people. And
right.
So what we have seen is because they have any cash they need available to them through the fiat currency system, they don't want for money. And so what we have seen, and we've got plenty of proof of it, is they get into debauchery, they become rakes, they get into all sorts of perversion as a part of their they get bored. They get bored with having all the power. And so they get off into these things. I mean, we're reading about, there's a group called the Hellfire Group that was around at the time of when Ben Franklin was in London. And it was this group of the aristocrats in Great Britain at the time that were truly into debauchery. That was their club. And they had special places they met. And so this penchant for human beings who are drunk with this kind of evil power is certainly there. And I think that to that extent, I think they're into symbolism. And so consequently, I think they play with the average person because they don't consider them human. They don't consider us human. They consider us chattel. In fact, we're just uncovering a document that was published in 1869, which is chapter and verse, shows that they considered human beings who were working in London as commodities to be shipped around into different countries, and they actually have it in, we actually have it in writing now. So we've always suspected and always seen it, but now we have it in their hand.
And you mentioned the British Privy Society, is that correct?
Privy Council.
Privy Council, that's it. I was looking at the word society, I thought that's not right. Okay, perhaps we could touch on this and some other things. This is, to say this is educational is almost an insulting understatement. This is amazing. I suspect many people out here have heard of this out there in radio land and stream land, but you know, if you don't hear a lot of it, and if you can't get a comprehensive lesson, which is what we're enjoying tonight, well, then you really don't get the whole story, do you? Ladies and gentlemen, we must take our top-of-the-hour break containing news, information, and a few commercials thrown in for good measure, but we'll be clear to the bottom of the next hour as we continue our most singular conversation with Mr. Michael T. McKibben on ARC Midnight. Stand by.